A crisis deferred.
Europe will keep cooking with Greece.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Jeff Horwich in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. It's Monday, June 18th.
Coming up, Greek election results will keep the euro together for the moment.
And oh, for the glory days of the U.S. bank bailout.
Plus, Australia looks to its crocodiles to bring tourists back.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
We'll start with Greece, where voters elected pro-bailout, pro-austerity political leaders to take power and form a coalition government in the coming days. Some economists worried that if the vote had gone the other way, we'd be facing an economic crisis. That didn't happen, but the celebration by investors was very brief, if you can call it much of a celebration at all. To explain, let's bring in Marketplace's New York bureau chief, Heidi Moore. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Jeff.
So we avoided the big meltdown here, but investors around the world seem to have had a pretty short party. What happened? Why did things deflate so quickly this morning?
Sure. Well, watching a European bailout is kind of like watching a Hollywood action thriller. You have to suspend disbelief to believe that the good guys are going to win. And in this case, the markets couldn't suspend disbelief anymore. They saw Greece taken care of. And then as soon as that was over, all of the other problems of the eurozone started to come to the forefront. And we're looking at four or five other countries that are waiting for bailouts behind even Greece.
So, Heidi, hang on for a minute. I want to bring in Marketplace's Stephen Beard, who's with us from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Jeff.
So if we can press pause on the Greek issue for the moment, is it Spain that just rises to the top of the heap of European worries now?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, as Heidi's pointed out there, Greece has a bit of a breathing space. It's not immediately going to fall off the cliff and crash out of the euro. So investors are now focusing on the next and potentially much bigger problem, Spain. Of course, Spain's banks were bailed out last week, but investors are increasingly thinking that the Spanish government itself may need a bailout soon. And Spain is more than four times bigger than Greece. Spain is going to be a lot more difficult for the European Union and the IMF to bail out. And that's worrying for the euro as a whole.
Let's continue our tour of Europe, Stephen. We also have election results from France this morning. What's the implication there?
The new socialist French president, François Hollande, has won control over his national parliament. That means politically he's going to be able to press ahead with his tax and spend policies. This strengthens his hand as he pushes for less emphasis on austerity and more on growth in the eurozone. But that sets up potentially the most serious and destabilizing conflict between the two most important eurozone countries, France and Germany. Mm. And Germany, again this morning, made it clear while they're prepared to talk about promoting growth, they still believe that austerity is all. The heavily indebted countries like Greece, Spain and Italy must pursue austerity if they want help from Germany.
And Heidi, back to you quickly. Leaders of the G20 are in Mexico today for a summit. Of course, they're talking about Greece. But what do you think President Obama and the American delegation would most hope to get out of this gathering?
They'd probably like an end to the European crisis, but they're not going to get that. What they want is to know that all of the finance leaders will support a bailout for all the countries that are in trouble before it has to become a unified global action. And they probably also want to see some growth from those European countries, which is hard right now because, as Stephen said, they're too busy cutting spending to really work on growing their economies.
Well, thanks to you both, Heidi Moore in New York and Stephen Beard in London.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Well, what a relief, you might say. And for some analysis of all of this, let's bring in Julia Coronado. She's chief economist at investment bank BNP Paribas. She's with us as she is every Monday. Good morning.
Good morning.
So I guess a relief, as I said, perhaps for some in the rest of Europe. What does all this mean for the euro debt crisis?
Well, as you said, we've averted disaster. So we're not talking about Greece leaving the eurozone this morning. But it doesn't really resolve the fact that Greece is on a very, very long and difficult road. So that question, while it's been pushed aside for the day, is not completely off the table. And there's still a lot of negotiating that needs to happen, and it's not going to be easy.
What does this mean for us here in the United States? Obviously, we've been talking about headwinds coming from Europe. Does this help us at all, our economy?
Probably not much. We've already been dealing with our own issues with another underperformance of the U.S. economy in the first half of the year. The data has been pretty weak. Manufacturing, retail sales all seem to be slowing. And the Fed is meeting this week, and they need to decide whether the U.S. economy needs another jolt. And I think that they are going to decide that they need to add a little more stimulus to get our own economy going.
Now, this Greek crisis has been sort of building for several weeks as we led up to this election over the weekend. Have any lessons been learned, do you think, going into this so that we don't just have crisis after crisis after crisis in Europe?
Well, I would like to say that we have. I mean, what I hope that the European policymakers are learning from the fact that each of these developments brings a shorter and shorter period of relief in financial markets is that you can't just keep kicking the can down the road. Ultimately, we need to know whether Europe has the will to stand together and form a fiscal union like the United States has, or something at least somewhat similar, or do they not? And it's a very, very difficult decision for these countries that all have different cultures and languages and traditions to make, to give up basically some of their own control for the greater good of the whole. But that's ultimately what needs to happen. And each of these little relief periods, again, they're just not lasting.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks as always.
It's a pleasure.
So how are Greeks feeling a day after the big elections? Well, last week we spoke with economist Dimitris Doulos at the American College of Greece, and he's back with us this morning from just outside Athens. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, last time we talked, I asked you if you were scared about this upcoming election. You said yes, you were. What did you do when you found out the results yesterday?
I felt kind of relieved, but it was a very close, very tight, 2.5 percentage point difference. So that's a very close difference. But I think today I feel a little better.
Well, what happens now? It's not as if the crisis is over.
Well, there must be a government as soon as possible, because I think this is our last chance. The new coalition government that we hope will be formed within a few hours or within the next few days, we hope that it will go ahead quickly with structural changes, so that we give to our partners in Europe to understand that we are serious and we are willing to go ahead with it.
Let me ask you one more thing. You're a professor. You talk to students all the time. How can the government going forward there convince young, educated Greeks to stay in the country instead of fleeing to other places where there's more opportunity right now?
Well, for the time being, it's very difficult to do it because the unemployment among young, educated people is very, very high. So it's very difficult to persuade a recent graduate to stay here. But I think if we have some growth measures that will quickly create jobs and will push Greece out of the recession, this mood will change gradually.
Dimitris Doulos is an economist at the American College of Greece. Thank you so much for talking with us again.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
The stabilizing election result in Greece does not change the reality that banks are on the brink in a number of European countries. And there's hot debate in Europe over just how much the European Central Bank should do to prop up, backstop, bail out. That's a problem we can relate to here in the States. Fortune Magazine senior editor-at-large Alan Sloan is here with me now. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Jeff.
So take us back to our own American bailout, 2008. What was the critical role that our central bank, the Federal Reserve, played in all of that?
Well, what it did was it invented ways to put money into institutions that it technically didn't deal with. So it put money into AIG and stopped a complete collapse. It put money into Bear Stearns and stopped a complete collapse. It did not put money into Lehman Brothers, and there was a complete collapse that scared everybody so badly that they didn't allow that stuff to happen anymore.
So I gather from what you've been writing lately that you're worried that if and when we faced another financial crisis, the Fed could not or would not play that critical role, that it's now sort of been pushed out of the bailout business. What's happened?
Well, there was this Dodd-Frank reform legislation, which, because of annoyance at the way the Fed just kept making up stuff and doing what it did, now when a large institution is on the brink of collapse, there's a very complicated method involving the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and the Treasury and all sorts of stuff. And this is supposed to stop a complete calamity from happening while punishing the guilty. The problem is the Fed can just do stuff and it doesn't have to go around and talk and make any deals. And this stuff is all going to be complicated and slow and political. So if there's a real crisis, you know, my problem is that you don't have anybody who can just deal with it.
You're worried that the Fed can't execute a bailout. It seems to me the whole point of this Dodd-Frank arrangement is that we don't want a bailout. We want to prevent the crisis if possible, and then maybe wind firms down in an orderly fashion if necessary, not bail them out. What am I missing here?
Well, if you look at what actually happened, the shareholders of many of the big firms were essentially wiped out. I'm all in favor of wiping out the people who lent money to these institutions. The problem is excluding the Fed specifically is going to make things much more complicated. I don't know what the next one's going to be, but it's going to be really ugly.
Alan Sloan, senior editor-at-large at Fortune Magazine. Great to talk with you. Thanks very much.
My pleasure, Jeff.
Well, now to that decision by President Obama on Friday to allow many young undocumented immigrants to work legally in the United States. Critics say the move will make a tough job market even tougher. Marketplace's Bob Moon reports on where the policy will have the biggest effect.
As many as 800,000 immigrants could benefit from the new policy, according to the Pew Research Center. Those immigrants are concentrated in such states as California, Texas, Florida, and New York, but they're as far-flung as Illinois and Georgia. Marta Tienda follows the demographics of immigration at Princeton University. She's not expecting a big impact to the labor market. As she sees it, the new policy just makes the jobs many of these immigrants already have official.
The issue is whether they're going to be working above ground rather than underground. The net change is likely to be very small.
Tamar Jacoby heads Immigration Works USA, a pro-reform coalition of employers. She argues the new policy could be good for the economy in the long term because it gives the young immigrants a legitimate path to upward mobility.
This is about whether these kids get educated and give back at a level of their full potential. So from the point of view of American productivity, this is helpful, not detracting.
Even so, she says, it's a small step, not an economic game changer. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Well, Jeff, if you are the child of a baby boomer, don't expect any inheritance checks.
What?
According to a study out today from U.S. Trust, boomers are about 20% less inclined than other adults under the age of 46 to leave money to their kids. They'd rather give to charity.
Well, Microsoft is expected to make a big announcement this afternoon in Los Angeles. Company isn't saying exactly what it will announce, but as Marketplace's Queen of Kim reports, the tech world has a pretty strong hunch.
If the rumor mill is right, Microsoft will unveil its own tablet today. But consider the roadblocks. Apple, Apple, Apple. And the roadkill. BlackBerry Playbook, the HP touchpad. Carolina Milanese is an analyst at Gartner. She says Microsoft has even more than the competition to worry about. It needs to unload the legacy of its own brand.
Corporate. It doesn't link to sexy and fun and consumer.
Microsoft is still a force in technology, but it's been losing ground to Google and Apple as people shift to smartphones and tablets. But there's one bright spot, the Xbox, Microsoft's gaming system, which streams movies, music, and some cable channels on demand. Scott Steinberg is an analyst at Tech Savvy.
They made no secret of the fact that they want to take over the digital living room.
A room that hasn't been so inviting to Google and Apple. And the big meeting today, it's in the entertainment capital of the world. In San Francisco, I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Today, some new federal rules for sunscreen products are supposed to take effect. The keywords there are supposed to. Turns out the sunscreen makers won't have to comply until that sunny month of December. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
The FDA regulations set new standards for everything from skin cancer protection claims to whether sunscreens are sweatproof. The FDA's been considering them since 2007. One of the agency's experts on sunscreens is Dr. Reynold, wait for it, Tan. Yeah, he gets that a lot.
It's been noted
Exactly a year ago, the industry was given today's deadline to change their labels, but sunscreen makers balked. They successfully argued that a year wasn't long enough to redesign their packaging. The lobbying worked. Dr. Tan says the FDA allowed a 6-month extension because the agency feared there could be sunscreen shortages this summer.
For example, a manufacturer might anticipate not being able to comply with all of the requirements. So he may decide not to market his product and decreased availability of sunscreen products. That's not in the interest of public health.
You might be surprised to learn the sunscreen lobby casts such a large shadow in Washington, but it's not really thanks to big sunscreen. Most sunscreen makers are huge cosmetics and pharmaceutical corporations like Johnson & Johnson, Merck, and L'Oreal. They have plenty of other issues to promote in Washington. The industry's two trade associations report spending nearly $6 million on lobbying over the past 3 years. The chair of the Personal Care Product Council's Sunscreen Task Force is Farah Ahmed. She says the FDA's new labeling regulations require a lot more space and might mean fold-out or wrap-around labels.
But, you know, when we're talking about a lipstick, that is still very difficult to do.
The sunscreen lobbying won't end here. Next up are safety guidelines for super small nano-sized particles in cosmetics, says Michael Hansen of Consumer Reports.
A lot of people have been asking that there should be required safety testing before these products come on the market, but none of that has been done yet.
Dr. Tan says so far the FDA isn't concerned about the small particles, but he says the science is evolving and new regulations may be coming. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Well, now to a very popular job opening. According to the Wisconsin State Journal, Jeff, more than 1,000 college seniors apply for this job every year. There are only 12 spots available. The job is to drive Oscar Mayer's Wienermobiles, which are just what they sound like, 27-foot-long hot dog cars, of course. The lucky drivers have to go to a 3-week hot dog boot camp where they learn to say things like, have a wonderful day, and thank you very much.
A job is a job, I guess, these days. We all know the story. Americans are overweight, and that costs us a lot as a country in healthcare spending and other ways. But a new study has discovered our obesity epidemic may be doing harm to other countries, too.
Here to talk with us for today's Midday Extra is Phil Edwards of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. He was one of the authors of the study. Hi, Phil.
Hi.
Well, what did you find in your study?
Well, we've estimated how much the human population of the world weighs, and we found that the total weight of 7 billion humans on the planet is around 290 million tons. And we've also estimated how much of that weight is due to overweight, so just due to fatness, due to fat that we don't need for our body and for our health. And that's around 15 million tons. And of course, it's distributed across the world in very different ways. And unfortunately, yes, North America hits the headlines again because it's the heaviest on average.
What do we know about the costs of being overweight? I mean, I guess we know that it means more medical bills and expenses, but the fact that you've been able to attribute some chunk of our weight on the planet to our obesity, what additional costs does that imply?
Well, all of our biomass requires food energy to be sustained. So every kilogram of weight that we carry requires food energy to maintain that, and agriculture, livestock rearing to make the food that we eat comes at a cost for the environment. So there's a lot of greenhouse gas emissions for the production of the food that we eat. So we can see that the impact on the environment is different depending on where in the world you're living, and that the increasing numbers on the planet is certainly going to be an issue, but the increasing weight that comes with that is also extremely important.
Well, other than letting us all know that we're a little too fat, Phil, what would you like us to do with this information?
What we've done is we want to feed this into the discussion that's going on worldwide on the sustainability of the planet and our lifestyle. So it's information that needs to be taken into account. We're all heading in a particular direction. We're all going to catch up with the North Americans, and China will develop and head that way. If we all do that, we will have an extra equivalent of an extra billion people on the planet, which is represented by our fatness. Now, that isn't a good thing for the planet. It's not a good thing for our individual health, as you already said.
So, Phil, who are the exemplary global citizens in this regard? I mean, who's in good shape, and what are they doing right? Or are they just in places with famine?
I mean, the Japan is an example of a country which is developed, and it has an economy. You know, I know it's had some troubles recently, but it's an example of a country which is very developed, very modern, and their distribution of population fatness is very relatively healthy. So it probably has something to do with the sorts of food that people are eating. But, you know, a lot of Europe is slimmer than us Brits. The Brits are the fattest in Europe. And I don't know what that might be, if it's to do with a desire of lifestyles that is about we can eat what we want whenever we want, and we don't need to burn any energy off because we can travel around in nice cars. So maybe that's has something to do with it. But we just need to keep our eye on where this is all going, because we're on a trajectory which isn't healthy for individuals or the planet.
So maybe more sushi, Phil.
I tell you what, I'm developing a taste, because I've just looking at my stomach, I realize over the last few years I'm just putting on a lot of weight, and I'm obviously eating the wrong things.
What I want to know is, if you have an extra billion pounds on the planet, does it actually spin slower?
That's another study that needs to be done.
There you go.
I dare say.
Phil Edwards of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
In Australia, they're looking for their own special kind of economic stimulus. The government wants to boost the sagging tourism industry. One idea, bring back the crocodile hunt. Here's Stuart Cohen in Sydney.
The professional crocodile hunters who now shoot along the rivers of the north use different methods and more modern equipment than the Aborigines.
It's been more than 40 years since recreational hunters were allowed to kill Australia's crocodiles. The country's untamed Northern Territory still has plenty of crocs. What it doesn't have is plenty of tourists, thanks in large part to a soaring Aussie dollar, which makes it expensive to travel here. The territory's chief minister, Paul Henderson, says crocodile hunting could help fix that.
Come to the territory and bag a croc. If that's what people want to do and they're prepared to pay for it, I'm all for it. We need a boost to our tourism industry.
Henderson wants to let hunters kill 50 crocodiles a year as part of a two-year trial. He says safari hunting will bring in millions of tourism dollars and create jobs for the impoverished Aborigine population. The proposal still needs federal government approval. Ironically, the family of the crocodile hunter, the late Steve Irwin, is one of the strongest opponents of the plan. In Sydney, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
And finally, from the UK, we have a new form of alternative energy, Jeremy. It's people.
People.
I'm not talking about Soylent Green here. That would be something to talk about. But researchers have developed a snap-on device that goes onto your leg to harness the power of our knees. Hmm. So every step you take charges a little generator that you could use to power something like, I don't know, a GPS unit, maybe personal cooling device. They're talking about putting it on soldiers to actually feed back into their movement and help them climb hills and stuff. Hmm. So that's what I call power walking.
There you go, Jeff. And I think actually probably most people will just use up all the juice on their mobile phones these days with all
charge them up
tweeting. And
in Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Horwich.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.